lecture, they can have two. Yeah, sure. Send them. Let them snake back. They can snake back and forth. Questions about anything? Anything that's left, I'm just going to eat, so it's probably better for my health if you eat it. Yes?
Just about the final, I guess. It's cumulative.
Cumulative, yep.
And there doesn't happen to be one of those nice little final examples online.
So I haven't put one online because I think it's better to look at your old exams than to look at an old final. It's possible when I get around to it, I might kind of cut and paste old questions from, you know, what might have been exam four. And maybe I'll look into doing that, but I certainly haven't done it yet.
What about for like the new questions?
Yeah, so that's what we're saying. So it's what you have is great for exams 1, 2, and 3, but it's less than perfect for the stuff since exam 3. Yeah, so right now you have the traditional study methods available for that material. And maybe if I have time, about half of the time I do, I'll post something that would be kind of exam 4 questions. At least maybe the equivalent of the short answer questions. What questions? Oh, this will sound great when recorded, right? The sound of crunching. Well, for people who watch television, they've learned this ditty, right? The whole universe was in a hot, dense state for the television show The Big Bang Theory. And there are kind of two things to remember about this ditty. So one is that the whole universe was that way. There's no edge, no firecracker. 100% of the universe has always been filled with stuff. There, as far as we can figure out, there aren't any empty spots in the universe. So for people who find expansion of something that is 100% filled problematic, I'm not sure what I can say. But that's the idea. If you have infinity, you can push off the problems where you can't see them, at least. Dense, maybe not as much as you might think, right? The universe is now mostly empty space, so you can compress it by a huge amount before it starts to get interestingly dense. So only at times less than about 100 seconds, for example, is it as dense as water. So you have to go to pretty early times before you get to pretty extraordinary conditions. So most of the time of the Big Bang is well modeled by what we can do in our laboratories. So because of the look-back effect, which remember is the fact that if you look at distant objects, you're seeing them as they were in the past. So if you look at something that's one light year distance, you're not seeing them the way it is today, you're seeing as it was a year ago. So because of that look-back effect, if you look at something that is 13.7 billion light years distant, you're looking at something that was formed soon after the Big Bang. And in fact, in every direction that we look, we see this microwave background radiation, and that seems to be from the plasma that was kind of like the surface of the sun at a temperature of about 3,000 degrees Kelvin, Doppler shifted because it's moving away from us by a factor of about 1,000. It looks like it has a temperature of just 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. And it's uniform to within a part in 100,000. But extraordinary efforts have been done to measure these non-uniformities because they contain all sorts of information about the early universe. In particular, this number 13.7 comes from a careful analysis of the ripples, the non-uniformities that are in that plasma that are due to sound waves that are propagating in that plasma. So these days people look at temperatures of a 10 millionth of a degree deviation from this already cold temperature of 2.7 degrees Kelvin in order to make these kind of extraordinary measurements. So this is the best way we learn about the early universe. Light that comes from about 400,000 years after the Big Bang, but the sound waves encode information about even earlier times. Another way we can study it is by looking at relics. So these are things that are robust enough that they've survived the early moments of the Big Bang and live on today. And by studying them, we can kind of figure out what the conditions were that formed them. So it's probably the biggest example of relics, are nuclei themselves. So in the early universe, composites would have been broken apart, so there weren't nuclei. So the nuclei that we know had to form. And at first blush, it's kind of surprising that everything didn't get burned up, that we don't have just ash, which you remember, iron is the lowest energy state. So it's kind of surprising that the Big Bang didn't just produce iron. And the reason that it didn't work that way has to do with what's available. So we've got neutrons and protons available in the early universe, and not much else. And protons colliding with protons, there's no stable state possible unless you have very rare reactions like the proton-proton chain that goes on inside the sun. Neutron combining with neutron doesn't make any stable product. So kind of the only possible first step is to have a neutron combined with a proton. Maybe before I comment on that, you may notice that there aren't neutrons around today. You can't buy them from a supplier, and that's because they radioactively decay in about 15 minutes. So only at these very early times are there any neutrons around, none inside the sun current, none that are free inside the sun currently. And it turns out that this first possible product is among the most delicate of nuclei. And so it only can survive at, relatively speaking, low temperatures. And so in order to start the process, we already have to have temperatures that are low compared to the temperature inside the hottest stars, for example. And once we get the deuterium, it pretty quickly cooks itself into helium-4. But then we've got another bottleneck, because helium-4 can't combine with anything in a binary reaction. It takes the 3-alpha reaction in order to cook helium to carbon. And by this time, the material isn't all that dense. And so 3-body reactions are relatively rare. So kind of a sidelight is why isn't 100% of the universe in helium? Why is only 25% of it in helium? And that has to do with the fact that the supply of neutrons run out. So basically all of the remaining neutrons, a good number of them have decayed during this 3-minute period when we start to have nucleosynthesis. And what's left is cooked into helium. So another kind of relic is that at earlier times yet, the universe would have been an equal mix of every particle and antiparticle and light all mixed together in more or less equal number. And if the mix was exactly equal, then the number of antiparticles should equal the number of particles, and we should have 100% annihilation. And it turns out we had close to 100% annihilation. A very, very small excess, on the order of a part per billion, was matter over antimatter. And so in that sense, all of today's matter is a relic. It's a particle that for reasons that I haven't explained yet, at least, have survived. I should comment that we started out talking about Ober's paradox. So that's the paradox that in a universe that is infinite and homogeneous and static, then it's not dark at night. And if you apply the contrapositive to that statement, the fact that it is dark at night tells you that the universe isn't homogeneous and infinite and static. So the ways we get out of that, of course, are by having distant objects Doppler shifted, and the fact that light, we can only see 13.7 billion years in our universe, because that's as long as the universe has been around. It's also useful to remember this parameter Z, which is the Doppler shift, the change in wavelength divided by the wavelength that we would measure in our labs, which means that 1 plus Z is the wavelength we observe divided by the wavelength that we observe in our lab. So for nearby objects, Z is like a 10,000th, so the wavelength isn't noticeably shifted. Most distant objects we can see have about a Z of about 7. This cosmic microwave background radiation comes from a Z of about 1,000. And the nucleosynthesis comes from a Z of about a billion.
So do we need to know that as far back as we can see, it's like 380,000 years after we met. You were talking about the paradox, and and you just said it. small amount of time.
Yeah, so we can see back to 3.7 billion years minus 400,000 years. So, you know, pretty much still 13.7 billion years. Is there a question in there? Or?
No, I was just confirming. I didn't remember the numbers.
So we seem to be, this paradox means that we seem to be surrounded by this wall of plasma, kind of like the surface of the sun, in all directions. Doppler shifted by a factor of 1,000 so that visible light is now microwave light. Questions? Well, we've looked at kind of lots of ways of putting together these pictures, and you can kind of simultaneously keep them in your mind. We got this picture here, in which we see the temperature and the density and the time and the constituents in the universe in this really funny scale that exaggerates these very early times, right? So that the solar system formed there and this is now. So that really, that millimeter distance there corresponds to 4.5 billion years, but that same distance here corresponds to 10 to the minus 42 seconds. So this is a scale that has intentionally exaggerated these very early times, in which interesting things are happening. We've got a picture kind of like this, which shows the principal constituents of the universe at various times in that similar sort of scale that exaggerates what's happening here at early times. And here's kind of another version of the same thing that I had up earlier. I think there's a version of this in the book that shows what the temperature is as a function of various sorts of times. So of course the fireball is cooling, and here we have the temperature at various times and various interesting features happening along the way. So here is where the microwave background radiation forms, where we go from ionized gas to transparent unionized gas. Here we have the words atoms formed, which I'm not particularly happy with, nuclei. Complex nuclei like helium form at this particular time and temperature. Questions? So the plan for today was to run the movie forward, to look at the Big Bang from the start as opposed to kind of working our way backwards, which is what we did last year. And what we want to do is to kind of simultaneously keep in mind this sky, this picture, and this picture. You have kind of versions of either one of them. This is a more simplified view with more easily read labels than the other one. So if we look at very early times, I think I've told you I have very little interest in times earlier than what's called the Planck time, on the order of 10 to the minus 42, 10 to the minus 43 seconds, because that's where all of our theories break down. We have no mathematical theory that would explain how the universe would work at these very early times when quantum gravity would be an important feature of what's going on. There are people who are interested in the cause of the Big Bang, which would of course require times before time equals zero, but those people don't include me, and necessarily any such conversation has to be very hand-wavy, right? Because there is no theory that works here, so there certainly isn't any theory that works here. So the work they've done is maybe interesting, but it falls under the range of speculation. Of course, to accomplish big things, you have to make kind of big leaps of faith, so good work to these people who are trying to work at very early times, but doesn't include me. So if we look kind of at intermediate times, and incidentally, so how far can we go back with our accelerators? So we can actually, an accelerator called RIC on the East Coast, I think it's in Virginia, can simulate what we think was going on with this plasma of quarks. So currently the quarks in the universe are confined to neutrons and protons. They'd be running around more or less free in this quark electron plasma that would exist at times earlier than 10 to the minus 6 seconds. So I think we can go back to about that time with Rick. This spot marked the electroweak transition. If we look at this picture here, you can see that this happens at energies that are about 1 TeV, and the Fermi National Lab has an accelerator that can get particles up to 1 TeV. CERN can go a little bit more than that, a little bit short of 10 TeV. So we're kind of on the ability to test this sort of behavior, but it's kind of on the edge of what we know. So everything earlier than that is based on the assumption that the theories that work here work there. And as I say, we don't want to go back to times earlier than 10 to the minus 43 because we know our theories are not going to work at those very early times. But if we accept that what we know where we can test it works where we can't test it, then the idea is what we've got here is what's sometimes called the desert. That is to say, not a lot of interesting things are happening. We just have running the movie backwards, ever hotter and denser plasma of quarks and leptons. So the principal constituents of the universe at this time would be photons and up quarks and down quarks and charm quarks and strange quarks and top quarks and bottom quarks and electrons and muons and taus and all the corresponding neutrinos and all of the antiparticles of all of that stuff and light, all mostly in equal numbers. Okay, so sometimes this is called quark soup, a complicated arrangement of more or less equal amounts of everything, with again just a very slight excess of matter over antimatter. And you know that the why of that very small excess of matter over antimatter, I mean, we'd like to know what that is. And so the hint is that this has to do with what's called grand unification. So this is, again, this is outside the range of what we currently know. But what we see up to this point is the behavior of the fundamental forces. So the fundamental forces are gravity, the weak force, the strong force, and electricity and magnetism. So 3 out of 4 of those forces, take gravity out of the picture because we don't know how gravity works at quantum levels, those forces are getting more and more similar as we go to higher and higher temperatures. So the idea is that at this transition, the weak force looks a lot like the electric force. So at this point, all of the forces we calculate would be acting more or less as one force, indistinguishable. And there are reasons to believe that some very special things happen at these very early times. Probably the most important thing on this list is what's called inflation. So the Big Bang is a massive expansion of the universe. Inflation is a bigger bang. So if we look at the ratio of the expansion of the universe from this time to now, and we compare it to the expansion of the universe that may have happened between, I don't know, 10 to the minus 30th seconds and 10 to the minus 32 seconds, this very small range of time, we actually think the universe may have expanded a whole lot more. So I don't want to sell this as known fact. This will never be duplicated in our labs. It's way too much energy is required. But there are hints that there could have been a huger expansion of the universe that happened at these very huger times and temperatures. So what's the evidence for that sort of kind of crazy idea that under situations that we can't duplicate in our lab, there was an even bigger bang than the one that we know about? Well, there are two bits of information that to me seem like interesting hints. So again, I'm not selling this as anything like fact, but as interesting speculation. So the first problem has to do with the uniformity of the cosmic background radiation. So if we look at the temperature of the material that we see here, and we compare it to the temperature of material we see there, they're the same to within a part in 100,000. And what's true is that these two pieces of the universe have never seen each other. They have never, if the standard Big Bang theory is correct, these two pieces of the universe have never had light that could travel from one area to the other. So kind of the question is, how could they decide on a temperature if they'd never been in any sort of contact? So the idea of this universe that is 100% filled, various pieces of it, particularly in the early universe, were separated by distances that didn't allow light to connect them. And so there's no way they could decide on a temperature to be. So we kind of have to posit in the current Big Bang theory that somehow or other, all the universe was created, 100% of it, all infinity of it, at one instant with the same temperature. And so that seems like kind of a funny assumption to make. And inflation is going to provide an alternative explanation for it. So problem one that inflation is supposed to describe is why is it that parts of the universe that could never have influenced each other, in fact, come up with the same temperature? So the other problem that inflation is supposed to solve is called the flatness problem. And we've talked about the curvature of the universe, and now I'm going to tell you that it looks like the universe is in fact flat. So the universe could have been positively curved, it could have been negatively curved, it could have had a more complicated curvature. It does in the vicinity of black holes, but overall on big scales it looks like the universe is flat. And there's no particular reason for the universe to be flat. All possibilities are there. Zero seems like an unlikely number to pick from a bag of random numbers. So we like there to be an explanation for why the universe is flat. Okay, so how does this inflation solve these problems? Well, the idea is that these two regions were really in contact at very early times, and then there was this huge inflation that occurred, this huge increase in scale at this very, very early time that we're talking about, this time of grand unification. Okay, in the standard theory, they wouldn't have been in contact, but if there was a huge increase, bigger than the current increase of the Big Bang, then those two guys could have been in contact at these very early times. Furthermore, if you blow up the universe like a balloon, it's going to look pretty flat. So if there was a huge increase in the scale of the universe at these very early times, it would also cause the universe to be flat at current times. And there are reasonable explanations for what exactly went on at these very early times. And they're going to kind of contradict the numbers that are on this piece of paper, which are all written in terms of the so-called standard model. So if there was this huge question.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure which would be flat. I mean, it's just so much longer in one direction that it makes it seem like the other directions are, like, how can the universe be flat if it's infinity in every direction?
So I don't see any connection between infinity and flatness. So first of all, remember what curvature of the universe means. It's a descriptive term which mathematically means the same thing as things that we can imagine curved, right? So we can see this piece of paper curved in three-dimensional space. But if our space is curved, it has to be curved in directions we can't actually experience. So kind of the usual analogy is to think of yourself as an ant on a curved surface. That's kind of like what we would feel like if our space was curved in a direction that we couldn't experience. So how you would measure the curvature of space is not in any particularly obvious way. It's in the failure of the Euclidean theorems. So if you made big triangles and they didn't add up to the interior angles didn't add up to 180 degrees, or if the circumferences of big circles wasn't 2 pi r, those would be signs of curvature of space. So the idea is that just as if you blow up a balloon, the surface is going to look flat, even though it has a slight positive curvature. The same thing of the universe. If it underwent an expansion of many, many billions of billions, then it would also appear to be pretty flat. It would measure pretty flat. Yeah, it's pretty much the same thing. Everyday experience seems like the Earth is flat. And you can set up nice coordinate systems to survey your yard that can assume it's flat. But if you start to make really big triangles, they won't add up to 180 degrees anymore, and you'll notice that the Earth is curved. So if you measure the distances between widely separated cities, it doesn't work out that way.
Yeah. So it's on a pretty enormous scale that we're determining the universe.
Yeah, so the universe could be curved on very small scales too, but we have measured it, and the curvature seems to be pretty close to zero. And if you ask how do we measure it, it turns out, like lots of things, the best way to measure it is by looking at these sound waves in the early universe. More questions? Well, you could measure the curvature of the universe in more direct ways, and this is kind of the old idea of how you would measure the curvature of the universe. So if you look at the volume of big spheres, Euclid claims that the volume should be going like the radius cubed. And while we can't measure the volume of big spheres, we think that galaxies are more or less uniformly sprinkled inside of them. We can look at the number of galaxies that are inside big spheres. So we can count all the galaxies that are within 1 million light years of the Earth, and then count all the galaxies that are within 2 million light years of the Earth, and work our way out, and we can see whether it seems to be following this relationship or not. And it turns out that if the universe has what's called positive curvature, which is the same sort of curvature that a sphere has, then the volume is a little bit less than what you would calculate with Euclid. Whereas if it's, there's the paper copy. Here we go, here's. So we can do this process, and if the universe were flat, then it would follow this radius cubed argument, and the number of galaxies should follow this line. If the universe is so-called open, then there would be extra space, space that Euclid says isn't there. On the other hand, just as with a sphere, if you make a big circle on the surface of the sphere, there's less surface area than you would normally think, right? So if you try and push an orange peel down, it cracks because there isn't enough surface area. So we can do this process of counting the number of galaxies in big spheres and see whether it satisfies flat or open or closed. So this is an old way of measuring the curvature of the universe, and it's relatively imprecise, and it says that it's flat. But, it could be this positively curved or this negatively curved. The sound from the Big Bang shows that it's pretty accurately flat. Incidentally, there are lots of analogies with these positively curved universes to spheres. So, for example, if we had a positively curved universe, then there would be a maximum volume. So if you walked forever in that direction, you'd come back to where you started with. Walk forever in that direction, and you'd come back to where you started with. That somehow or other, the universe would be connected up into some sort of spherical pattern. Kind of like those games that you play on screens, right? Where your creature goes off this way and it comes in that way. Goes off this edge and it comes in the next edge. So people have actually looked for that phenomena. If you look in that direction real hard with the Hubble Space Telescope, do you in fact see the same things that you see if you look this way really hard with the Hubble Space Telescope? And it doesn't seem to be the case. Doesn't look like the universe is closed. Looks like the universe is flat. And that would be explained by the inflation. More questions?
Say again? What exactly is antimatter? You talked about matter versus antimatter, but
where
does it come from?
Star Trek, right? So the idea of antimatter goes back to a guy called Dirac, who is probably one of the most famous physicists who you've never heard of, circa 1932. And I'm not sure what I can say about it, except that antimatter is the exact opposite, kind of normal matter. So that normally we think of an electron as having a negatively charged, being a negatively charged particle. An antimatter electron has a positive charge on it. And when these two guys meet, they annihilate, and all you would get out of this is light. So Dirac actually predicted the existence of antimatter based on the equations that he was working on. And then, I don't know, like a year later, antimatter electrons were discovered. And these days, we believe that every particle has an antimatter component. So protons have positive charge. In the 50s, they were able to make antiprotons. And when these two guys get together, they annihilate. So every particle has a corresponding antiparticle. And in Star Trek, people have anti-people. I don't know about that. And they worry about them getting together and destroying the universe. But
is that like the Spock and the beard?
Say again?
The Spock and the beard.
Or like Uhura Picard. I think it was an Uhura Picard.
Yeah, like the evil.
Oh, so this actually goes back to the very first versions that
oh, really?
That I was watching. It was a really bad one. No, I think it was a person. I don't think it was any person on the Enterprise in the original version. It was, you know, this the person who you know who's going to die because they aren't listed in the credits. Yeah. So that I think there have been evil people, but they. This whole idea of antimatter people is absolutely crazy. Because if you had an antimatter person, if they stepped on the carpet, they have antiprotons in their foot, and there are protons in this carpet, and they would annihilate. So you don't have to have a person just like you who is made out of antimatter to annihilate. You would annihilate with any antiproton, any normal proton that's around. So this is CERN. So CERN is kind of the successor to Fermilab, and I was pointing at the energies on this diagram. So Fermilab outside of Chicago produces about 1 TeV, and CERN is supposed to produce a little bit short of 10 TeV, more energy particles that are being collided. And what was kind of almost announced yesterday has to do with the electroweak unification. And it doesn't play a big role in our story, so I wasn't going to talk about it, but Peter Higgs is a Scottish physicist, and he invented this particle. Oh, it's kind of a long story. But the Higgs particle, so I can make these statements and they're not going to be supported by anything. So Leon Letterman wrote a book called The God Particle. Leon Letterman is a Nobel Prize winning physicist from Fermilab. He's a nice guy. He wrote a book called The God Particle, which deals with the Higgs particle. And kind of the reason he called it the God Particle is it's the basis of all mass. So the kind of fundamental idea is that particles are all born massless like light. And by interacting with this Higgs particle, which is omnipresent, they pick up the appearance of mass. So Higgs had a real hard trouble convincing people that this was the case. But the real, I don't want to give Higgs too much credit for this, because in my opinion, the real heroes are the other Nobel Prize winners, Weinberg and Salam. So Salam was working at Trieste, and Weinberg, I think, was at Harvard at the time. He's now at University of Texas. They invented this theory, which is called the electroweak unification theory. And as kind of a small piece of that theory, they incorporated what's called the Higgs mechanism for giving masses to all their particles. But their theory did, and so that's, up until that point, Higgs theory had been kind of a footnote. But the Weinberg-Salam theory was the first effective theory of the weak force. And so it should occur at about this, it should be noticeable at about this same energy range. And so that's what may have been was kind of announced. They saw some interesting peaks, which are not yet statistically significant, at about where we expect the Higgs to come in. And the promise is that next year, when they get more data, the Higgs will be all there. At a mass that is about 100 times the mass of a proton. So things are, the upshot of all of this is that as people work out the details of the selectral weak theory, it seems to be working out pretty much exactly as Weinberg and Salam wrote it down in 1967. Incidentally, if you want my, so I'm a super fan of the Weinberg-Salam theory, but my bet is that things will be, turn out to be a little bit more complicated. They wrote down the simplest possible theory for the Higgs. This is way more than you care to know. They wrote down the simplest possible theory for the Higgs model. And, you know, sometimes the simplest possible thing works out, but as often as not, there's some additional complication. So I'm betting that while the Higgs mechanism is largely approved, there'll be something new and interesting discovered. So that's maybe a story that's worth telling. There's a long history in particle physics of people inventing a new machine in order to do X that is moderately interesting, and in the process discovering something that's way more interesting. So for example, I mentioned that the antiproton was discovered in Berkeley in the 50s. So they built this big machine that had enough energy that it could create an antiproton. But the antiproton was really a pretty dull discovery. I mean, it just fit in line with what Dirac had said in 1932. But what they discovered were lots of other interesting things, the so-called resonant particles, the mesons, and all of that. Same thing with Fermilab. It was kind of discovered to do high energy physics, but it was really the one of two sources for the quark theory. And so pretty much the justification for the CERN collider was to find the Higgs, but pretty much everyone thinks that they'll discover lots of other things that we can't imagine currently. And that kind of begs the question about this desert. So we calculate that nothing interesting is going to happen in this huge energy range, but I don't know that any of us actually believes that that's the case, right? Every other time when we've turned on a new accelerator, we found lots of new and interesting things. And maybe this is the one time where we turn on a new accelerator and only dull stuff comes out. But I'm not betting on that. I don't think anyone's really betting on that. Questions? So I wanted to say a few more words about this inflation because it's kind of radically different from the numbers that are on here. If we have it, if you let gas escape from your tires, you'll find out that the gas has cooled. And the same thing has to be true with this inflation. If there was this sort of inflation, the universe had to have cooled hugely during this huge expansion. So the temperature right after this expansion had to be actually colder than this 3 degrees that we've been writing about for the current temperature of the universe. But then the universe is reheated by the production of, the reduction of vacuum energy, as it turns out. So I guess what I just want to say is that accompanying this huge expansion, there's also a huge cooling. But the universe is reheated, so we get back to the same line that we were on earlier. So this data, these numbers would not be exactly appropriate if, in fact, inflation occurs at that point. Okay, so inflation, somewhat speculative. It does explain some kind of puzzles that we have. It's hard to see how it'll ever be proven right or wrong just because it deals with these energies that are never going to be possible to create on Earth, right? So we go from here to here in 10 years of hard work. There's, you know, maybe in another 10 years we'll go to there, but there's really just no imaginable way we're going to go to test those energies in laboratories. Okay, so that's kind of the one interesting thing that may be in the desert, this huge inflation that occurs. So the next kind of interest, and incidentally, corresponding to this, at roughly the same time, this is where people think lots of other interesting things may happen. In particular, this origin of the matter-antimatter asymmetry. That at the same time, some particles that were produced that had slightly more matter produced when they decayed than antimatter produced. And that very small relic, of course, survives into our time and into your bodies. Say again?
We currently don't observe anything that goes faster than speed of light.
So there's this experiment that claims that neutrinos move faster than the speed of light, which I haven't met anyone who believes. So yes, there are published reports of something moving faster than the speed of light that are signed by on the order of the paper has about 100 physicists as the author. It also comes out of the same CERN collaboration, but doing different sorts of stuff. But it just can't be the case. It has to be a mistake.
I guess one of the questions when you talk about that inflation, it's like millions of a second, and you're saying the whole thing was expanded in that time. So like how do they
Yeah, so a millionth of a second is a lot of time. So these things are all way shorter than a millionth of a second, or even a millionth of a millionth, or even a millionth of a millionth of a millionth. So the sort of times we're talking about are a billionth of a billionth of a billionth. Really short times. Yeah, so we're saying that in actually less than a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second, there was a huge expansion of the universe, bigger than the expansion that has occurred from that time to the present time. Well,
it just happened. Like, it isn't like if you observe, you'd be like, well, it wasn't exactly instantaneous.
Yeah, well, so one time I was teaching this class and a student said, I think we're getting too much detail. He wanted to quit, but of course I didn't want to quit. I am interested in this stuff. But yeah, for any practical purpose, right, so... So here's a millionth of a second, you know, and it's only about halfway through this picture, right? So we're talking about all of this stuff that's happening at these very early times. So there are good reasons not to talk about times much earlier than a millionth of a second, because remember, that's also about as good as we can reproduce in our laboratories. But we're always interested in stuff that's just beyond what we can actually do, right? So you don't get a Nobel Prize for doing old stuff. You get a Nobel Prize for doing new stuff. So people are always trying to work on this sort of stuff. More questions? Okay, so in terms of this constituent table, so here's maybe, so the GUT stands for Grand Unified Theories. Here was this inflation that we were talking about. Here's this quark soup plasma that we're talking about. Here's where we have the electroweak transition, where for the first, so at the Grand Unified Theory, remember all the three forces, electricity and magnetism, the weak force and the strong force, all look like one force. Here's where the weak force cuts out and it starts to be a distinct sort of force. Here's where we start to actually have neutrons and protons as composites. So here the temperatures are big enough that the neutrons and protons have been broken apart. Here the temperatures are low enough so that neutrons and protons can exist as composites. But nothing more than neutrons and protons can exist at these high sorts of temperatures. So in this region, So at about the same time, there's a huge annihilation of antimatter quarks with matter quarks to just leave a relatively few protons behind. But at this point, we still have antimatter electrons and matter and normal electrons. So the huge annihilation of electrons and anti-electrons happens at about 1 second after the Big Bang. And that's also about the time when the universe becomes transparent to neutrinos. I think we talked a little bit about this last time. So here's the neutrino line, and here's where neutrinos start to fly free at roughly speaking 1 second. And the reason they're now the universe is transparent to neutrinos is we've gotten rid of 99.99999% of the electrons and anti-electrons in a huge annihilation. And that huge annihilation does, of course, reheat the universe a little bit at those times of about 1 second. So it might be useful to also bring up this other picture you've got, if I can find it. Well, it's not that. Well, I want that picture, I guess, so maybe I'll dig a little bit more for it. Should have been out. Not there. Okay. I'm about to either... It's that picture that I'm looking for. You've got it. I'm the one who doesn't have it. Well, I can't for the life of me imagine what happened to it. It's decided to hide on me. Oh, here it is. It's sitting on top of my book. So this is a map. This is a plot of the density of the universe. And, you know, kind of to get things in roughly equal proportion, the density of water is about 1. You know, so at times less than that, then we're talking about the density of the universe being less dense than the density of water. So here, what's happening here is we have a huge drop in the density of neutrons and protons. That's this annihilation of neutrons, of antiprotons and protons, antineutrons and neutrons, to just leave a relatively few neutrons and protons around. And that same annihilation is happening with electrons at this point. So there's a huge drop in the number of electrons and anti-electrons at this annihilation at this time. Notice that before that time, roughly speaking, the number of electrons and anti-electrons was about the same as the amount of light, which is what the radiation line is measuring. So remember I said early in the universe we had top quarks and bottom quarks and their antimatter quarks and electron. All of those things had roughly co-equal number with light in these very early times. So when we have this huge drop in the amount of matter, when the anti-electrons and the electrons annihilate, that's when the density drops enough for the universe to become transparent to neutrinos. And so that's when the neutrinos start flying free. But of course, the plasma that is free electrons and neutrons and protons, that's still opaque to light. So for light to fly free, we have to wait for the composite that is atoms to form so that the universe could become transparent to light. Okay, more on that diagram in a second. So again, working our way forward, once we get this right side up. So quark soup, here we have neutrons and protons, no antimatter neutrons and protons, but antimatter electrons. Here we have the die-out of the antimatter electrons as the temperature cools. Temperature finally gets cold enough to form nuclei as composites, right? So that's what we were talking about last time, nucleosynthesis. We start to get nuclei that include neutrons and protons bound together, and in particular, helium-4. So this is where 25% of the universe is converted into helium, and what's left over is hydrogen. The neutrons, of course, are all going to be either decayed or they're going to be incorporated into helium. And very little else is produced for the reasons we talked about last time, the bottlenecks. So at these times, we have a universe that consists of light and electrons and the nuclei that we've just talked about. But what is true at this point is that the mass of the universe is mostly in the form of radiation, mostly in the form of light. So it may seem funny to talk about light weighing stuff, But light has energy, so it has corresponding mass. So most of the universe at these times is in the form of light. It's not in the form of material. Since the amount of light depends on the temperature to the fourth, remember, you make a small change in temperature, you get a huge change in the amount of light, it's going to turn out that with the expansion and cooling of the universe, the amount of energy that's in light is going to get smaller and smaller faster than the amount of material in the universe due to matter is going to decrease. So at about 100,000 years, this graph saying a million years is old-fashioned, at about 100,000 years, we think that most of the material in the universe was in the form of matter as opposed to light. And remember that it's at about 400,000 years after that that we finally get the universe transparent to light. So this difference between the universe being dominated by light and being dominated by matter has an effect on the expansion rate. Right, so here we have the behavior of temperature versus time. And you can see there's kind of a break in this graph when the universe becomes dominated by material as opposed to by light. Right? Things are happening faster now. Once we have the universe dominated by matter as opposed to light, then we have the possibility of structure formation, right? At earlier times, matter was, you know, the tail of the dog, and it really couldn't get together to start to form structures because light was the dominant feature. When matter dominates, we start to have, basically from these cores of sound waves where the matter is a little bit dense, you have self-gravitation starting to bring together clumps of matter. Not stars or anything more complicated than that, but at least we can start to have some sort of clumping, and it's that clumping that we start to see as the ripples in the microwave background radiation. Okay. So let's kind of take a step back and think about what Newton would say about throwing things up. Right? So in some sense, we can think about the Big Bang as a huge expansion that's throwing material apart. And generally speaking, at least when I throw this piece of chalk up, if it goes up, it's going to come back down. So kind of a fundamental question is the explosion that started the universe strong enough to continue forever, or is the gravitational attraction of the universe going to bring it all back together in what's sometimes called the Big Crunch? So currently, as we're pointing at points on this plot, the universe is expanding. Will that expansion slow because of the effects of gravity, stall, and then recollapse? So that's a question that was very much on the mind of astrophysicists in the 90s, basically because there was a preference, I would say, a kind of a theological preference, for a universe that would suffer a recollapse. But the data consistently showed expansion forever. So people were trying to get better and better measurements about the rate at which the universe was, the expansion of the universe was slowing due to these effects of gravity. So the way you do that, of course, is by looking back in time, right? If you look at distant objects, you're seeing what the universe was like at those times. So you could see if the expansion, how much the expansion had slowed between, you know, 10 billion light years ago and the current rate of expansion. And what they found was mind-blowing. I was in the audience when it was announced and I didn't believe it, just like I don't believe the speed of light result. And what they saw was that the universe wasn't slowing, it was speeding up. So even if I throw this piece of chalk fast, as it goes up, it's going to be going slower and slower and slower. So the possibility that something would rocket the universe even faster apart, kind of made no sense. So we're talking 1998, the guys who did this work got the Nobel Prize this year. So we get what's called an accelerating universe. And it turns out there was already a handy explanation for what could be causing the acceleration of the universe. So when Einstein wrote down his theory of general relativity, so this is before Hubble, so this is back when people were thinking about the universe as being more or less a static situation, he had a problem. He had a problem because his theory was more or less going to say the same thing as Newton's theory, right? So if we have a block of universe, and that's kind of how he thought about it, there probably was an edge to the universe in Einstein's mind, then it's going to either recollapse or expand, depending upon what the velocity was. So he didn't like, kind of for religious reasons, he didn't like either one of those answers. He wanted there to be a universe that could just kind of hover there. So he needed to create a force which was repulsive, that could hold the universe apart from itself while gravity is trying to pull it together. And it turns out there's a natural way to do that in his general theory of relativity that he called the cosmological constant. And it's pretty much always denoted with that symbol, which is a capital lambda. So he invented this constant in order to make a static universe, and then about 10 years after that he wrote down his general theory of relativity, Hubble came up with the expanding universe, and he said, well, that's the greatest blunder I ever made. Let's just get rid of this term in my equation, and everything will be happy. But this cosmological constant, which is a repulsive nature of gravity, is exactly what you need to be causing the observed acceleration. So suddenly in 1998, theories that had a cosmological constant were back in vogue in order to explain this accelerating explosion.
So this would be like anti-gravity
stuff. Yeah, so some people even call it levity. So in Einstein's view, it would be in the nature of gravity at very large distance scales not to be attractive but to be repulsive. So it's not noticeable in the solar system because it's not big enough, but if we look at big enough pieces of the universe, it would want to expand kind of automatically. So kind of this discovery of the accelerating universe solved a variety of problems all at once. And what it means is that the future of the universe is to have this explosion not just continue, but to accelerate. So in the future, galaxies are going to be receding from us at higher and higher rates of speed, and eventually going to go out of sight because their light is going to be Doppler shifted beyond what we can possibly observe. So kind of the future of the universe in this model is going to be darkness, as the rest of the universe moves away from us at very high speed due to this cosmological constant. So there's a variety of different takes on the cosmological constant. And my guess is that you haven't heard that word, but you may have heard this word dark energy. So those two things mean exactly the same thing with a slightly different emphasis. So the idea of the cosmological constant, as Einstein originally wrote it down, is that it was in the nature of gravity to be repulsive at large distance scales. In the point of view of the people who are talking about dark energy, they're thinking that there is some physical thing that is causing the universe to expand, and they've given it the name dark energy. So dark energy may be some sort of mysterious stuff, or it may just be in the nature of gravity that it has this expansive behavior. Those are just different points of view of the same thing. People who take this one step further, sometimes this is less common these days, but sometimes dark energy is also called the quintessence, reminding you of this word that Aristotle invented to describe a new element, right? Material that is only present in space. So don't confuse the dark energy with the dark matter. And don't confuse dark matter with anything that we're used to. These are all different sorts of stuff. And kind of the surprising feature that we learned basically by studying these microwave background radiation is the relative amounts of these various things. So it turns out that in kind of round numbers, the dark energy is something like 70% of the universe, And this dark matter is something like 25% of the universe. And everything that you're made out of, everything that we know about, everything that we can see, is maybe 5% of the universe. So this is kind of a huge, if you think about the Copernican Revolution as being something that separated us from being central in the universe, we just keep getting more and more separated, right? We're not the center of the universe, we're not the center of the solar system, we're not the center of the galaxy. Our galaxy isn't a particularly impressive galaxy. It's not at the center of things. The Virgo cluster is the nearest one of those things. Clusters of galaxies aren't the big thing, right? It's the superclusters. And everything we've talked about is made out of atoms, and atoms are small change. So it's kind of a discouraging feature about how unimportant everything we know is in the universe as a whole. So dark energy, it may be stuff, but Einstein would have said it's just in the nature of gravity. Dark matter really has to be stuff. And I think most people believe at this point, it's in the form of some weakly interacting massive particle, which remains to be discovered. I think I've said several times that there's an experiment at Sudan Mine that is looking for them, so far unsuccessfully. And then everything we know and love, and of course most of what we know and love is hydrogen, right? And of course that is relatively rare on Earth. We're made out of kind of the tip of the iceberg. Most of the universe is in the form of hydrogen and helium, both of which are not particularly obvious on Earth, right? So the stuff we know about is all of this stuff, and it's way rarer than the hydrogen itself. What does it all mean? So Weinberg, whose name I erased, who's now has as much gray hair as I have, maybe more. So he wrote a famous book called The First 3 Minutes. Right, which was dealing with exactly the stuff that we were talking about before, how the universe cooks neutrons and protons into the first nuclei. And he did this, I'll say around 1975 or 1980, something like that. So it's, at this point, it's a pretty old book, still very much worth reading. And he says in there something like, the more you learn about the universe, the more pointless it seems to be. He got into big trouble for writing that. So I don't know if I believe that, but that's what Steven Weinberg regretted putting into print. More questions?
So we're saying that it's infinitely expanding in an infinite amount of space. What would happen if you were on the other side?
Well, what's the other side mean, right? Because we think the universe is homogeneous, so any place you could go in the universe would look more or less like this place looks like.
You were saying like it's infinite, but it's also infinitely expanding. So
yeah.
Does that mean it's expanding into infinity?
Yeah. So usually, if I take this stick and I expand it, the only way I can expand it is if this piece moves into previously empty space. And I'm saying that's not how it works. So if you have actually an infinite line and you double it in size, it still fits in exactly the same state. So there is no point in the universe that would look any different from this point looks like. It would all look like it's moving away from you. It all look like it's expanding. And I've kind of pushed off any problems to spots that I can't see them. There is, incidentally, I don't think this is a... Are there other questions? Maybe I'll ask this first. So if you look in the book, there's a relatively large piece of the material that I would say is of historical interest only. And it's talking about the mass density of the universe. So before people realized that the cosmological constant was important, there seemed to be just two possibilities, right? And that's the possibilities that what goes up comes down, or what goes up expands forever. And that just depends on how much mass there is in the universe. If there's lots of mass, the consequence is the Big Crunch. And if there's little mass, then the consequence is forever expansion. And there's some sort of dividing line in which you would still actually turn out to have forever expansion, but it would be at a slower and slower rate. That's where you just have exactly the escape velocity. So it turns out that theories like this have a finite volume. They are just like a sphere where there are only so many sort of locations that you can experience. Under that sort of phenomena, you can see how you can have expansion in a clearer way than this number line story that I was telling you, right? The radius of the sphere could expand, and we could get new surface area seemingly from nothing without this sort of possibility. In these sort of situations, then the universe was infinite, and it has the curvature that you have on a saddle. So-called negative curvature as opposed to positive curvature. And there is a, people were trying to figure out which side of this dividing line we're on. Well, it turns out that the cosmological constant throws all of that away. We have to be in an infinite universe. And it's going to expand forever. And this possibility, seemingly, you know, kind of for religious reasons, maybe a kind of a nicer possibility where things are like a sphere and you can kind of see how you get more volume out of nothing. Those seem to be ruled out. Was there a question over here? More questions? So I quit with 2 minutes to spare. Any exam sort of questions? Oh, I know what I want to ask you about. So remember I talked about how do I test the name the dot sort of question. So I can think of three options, and I'm happy to have you vote on them. So option one is to retest the winter hexagon. So you have to name those stars, and then I'd also make you name the constellations too. So that's more or less like what we did on exam three. Option two is more or less like what we did on exam two. So I'd give you dots of those list of constellations, and you would have to name the constellations, and if there were an important star in it, you'd have to circle it. Right, so for example, Regulus, which to me looks kind of like this, or Leo, you'd have to circle that dot, which is Regulus. Three, none. No questions on dots. So I think you might have a tendency to think three is the obvious answer. But that doesn't mean I take a question off the exam. That means I put a different question on the exam. So this is substituting a known quantity for an unknown quantity. Okay, so now the vote. Winter hex. Okay, so it's going to... Exam two. Okay, so there will be a question on the exam in which looks exactly like the question on exam three. Dots and lines. Name the stars and name the constellations this time.
I'll be here Friday, so like, what should we study?
Everything is the short answer.
Is it, can it be like totally cumulative, or are you going to concentrate? Like,
yes, it's cumulative.
But we haven't tested on what we've been learning.
Yes, it'll be on the exam. So if a logical way of writing the exam would be to overweight the material since the last exam, since it's the stuff that hasn't been tested on. And I won't do that just because I love all those old questions that were on your exams, and I just can't bear to delete them. So there'll be lots of questions that are repeats from your old exams. There'll be some questions, you know, less than a quarter of the exam, that's on the stuff that we've covered since the last exam.
You have to know the spectral types.
Yes, so I love that. That's on your exams with a question that I, so I would.
For the winter hex.
Oh yeah, for the winter hex, it's the same as it was for exam 3 plus constellations. Questions? Okay, so I'll see you all study day, or some of you, if not for the final. Good luck. Sure. You might drop me some email so I remember, but
yeah.
I probably will remember anyway.
Okay.